Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Our colleagues at Gothamist capture the culture and stories of New York City. And this week we're talking about libraries, boats, reclusive writers, and statues. Oh my. In studio we have Jake Offenhartz, Claire Lampin, Liz Kim, and Jen Carlson. I'm sorry, I was trying to read without looking up. Thanks guys for coming in.
Thank you.
Liz, we're going to start with you. Here's your headline. The new $41 million Hunters Point Library has one major flaw. Okay, so a $41 million library. What's the backstory on that?
So this was a library that was started, depending how you count, it could be anywhere between 15 to 20 years ago. And that's just talking about the conception of the library. And it was started under Bloomberg, under this program that was meant to create municipal buildings that were of high quality and that would make a real architectural statement. So this project got started, and it took a long time. There have been several delays, both in the building process, also in the planning process, and possibly funding as well. So there was a lot of pent-up anticipation for what this library would finally be.
And then when it opened up, everyone thought, oh, this is a beautiful architectural marvel. It was considered initially architecturally successful, right?
Rave reviews. Everybody loved it. Michael Kimmelman gave it a great review. Justin Davidson of New York Magazine also loved it. And so it was great, right? They were like, oh, great, you know, we finally got this library out. But then during the tour, they took us up the steps. And the staircase is actually a real centerpiece of its design because it's flanked against these beautiful carved out windows. And as you're walking up the staircase, you're basically taking in the views. You're looking at these beautiful wooden bookcases. But then it occurred to me, I said, how will a person who is either disabled, elderly, anyone who has any kind of mm-hmm. mobility, disability, walk up these stairs? And at the time, they kind of glossed over it and they said, well, there is one, we do have an elevator, but the elevator only stops at one of the levels, not the three other levels, which were being used to house fiction books. So then, a week goes on and then someone else wrote to us about this, about this exact same thing. And I thought, well, this really deserves a story because I'm not crazy. This is a real issue. At the time, they said, oh, it's not going to be a problem because we will just have a librarian assist anyone who needs to retrieve a book.
Nobody wanted to hear that.
Nobody wanted to hear that. So then, sure enough, it turned into something that other people had raised to them. And then ultimately last week, they decided that they were going to remove those fiction books. It's not clear what they're going to do with those three sections but it's not going to be used to house.
Was it ADA compliant? Technically,
it is ADA compliant. And even the fact that they had this workaround where they said, we'll just have a librarian assist any patron that needs to get a book but cannot, that is a legal workaround. But as some people have stated, I mean, it's not just about fulfilling a legal obligation, right? Mm-hmm. In this day and age, accessibility should be weaved into all parts of design, especially for a library of all places.
Made me think, I'm just going to editorialize for a minute, about diversity in the planning process.
Oh.
You know, because maybe if someone had someone in the family who had this issue, or even, baby strollers.
Well,
parents love libraries.
Well, it's particularly shocking because it's a very renowned architect, Stephen Hall. His firm designed it.
It looks gorgeous.
And, you know, if the whole idea was that we were going to build these spaces and use quality architects, then this is kind of a stunning turn of events, right? Because you would think that, you know, architects, you know, preeminent architects are now thinking about things like accessibility.
They will now in New York City. Thank you, Liz. Okay, this is you. Jake, this has been your beat, man.
Yeah, we've done a lot on this story.
Judge orders billboard boat to go to go the hell back to Florida. That's quite a headline.
See ya.
So this was this a company, Ballyhoo, right?
Ballyhoo Media, yeah.
All right, so they had this boat that was going up and down the East River that was like this big sort of bright thing, right?
Yeah, large LED screens pointing ads for things like Pets 2 and helicopter rides at the city's waterfront for the past year.
And people did not like this boat, right?
No, no, people really did not like it. We heard from some people who wanted to sink it, which didn't happen in that way. But the city did file a lawsuit back in March, and earlier this week, a settlement was announced in that lawsuit. And as part of that settlement, Ballyhoo has to go back to Florida. They have to like literally bring the vessel back there. They're forbidden from operating in any of New York's waterways. And if they do, they have to pay $100,000.
All right. But the thing I remember about this story was the CEO of this company.
Yes.
Adam is Shapiro. A character.
Yeah.
He's someone who interprets things as in certain ways, shall we say?
Sure. I think that's accurate.
So how was he, what is he, doesn't say think he's done anything wrong.
Still. No, he's taken sort of a Trumpian legal approach to this, and that he has, at every turn, because there's also been a state law, at every turn he has sort of undermined this process, and he has refused to concede that there is anything illegal about operating this large ad boat in the city's waterways. There are several resolutions at the city and state level that do apply to this. Even at the end of the settlement, in which a judge ruled that he was in violation of the law, or settled this lawsuit that said he was in violation of the law, he still sent us a statement that says, while we did nothing wrong, we're going to focus our opportunities elsewhere. Goodbye, effectively. For now.
Are there any ad boat cops? Like, who's gonna make sure there's compliance?
The NYPD is technically in charge of enforcement. Again, there was a state law banning these things that was signed in August. The only reason they haven't really been kicked out before then, I think, is because the NYPD wasn't sure how to handle this. Mm-hmm. The one other thing I'll say about this, as the city is doing its victory lap, Adam Shapiro, in his final statement to us, pointed out that the resolution applies to New York. It may not apply to New Jersey. A lot of the Hudson River is on the New Jersey side. Conceivably, he gets a bigger boat, returns to the Jersey side of the Hudson River, and we continue writing many stories about this.
I was about to say, this isn't over for you, Jake.
Yeah, no,
this is
it'll never
end. All right, Claire, you're up next. Your headline is, a monument for remembering all those tourists taken by the wolves.
Yes.
So, a statue about tourists taken by wolves.
yes, dealing with New York's famous wolf problem.
Clearly.
So, in Battery Park, if you head down there in the next couple of days, then you might see a sort of medium-sized bronze sculpture, not huge, featuring three wolves menacing a man with a camera around his neck, presumably a tourist. And it is a memorial to all of the tourists who have been murdered by wolves at night, which, yeah, not a real thing.
I was going to say, my big question is, why?
Well, a fun thing that I learned about while making this blog was that former Mayor Ed Koch did actually propose bringing in packs of wolves to drive people out of train cars at night in the 80s.
Oh, Ed.
Which sounds very easily like it could be a joke.
But he was a funny guy.
A real
I have to
suggestion,
say.
Yeah.
He was a funny guy.
That way.
So who's behind this?
It's a local artist named Joseph Riccinella, and he has been described by the New York Times as the Banksy of monuments. So you may have seen his other works. There was one about a NYC UFO tugboat abduction. He makes these bronzes and then places them in different areas around New York, and they look fairly realistic. And often they're pegged to a date or a historical moment where something really big happened. So this smaller, weird, invented moment of history conceivably could have been overshadowed by that. But yeah, he constructs elaborate hoaxes, and yes.
It's in Battery Park now?
It's in Battery Park now. It'll probably move around.
Okay. I just want to tell you something. Team Gothamist, they work. When they're not talking, everybody's on their computers. I just outed you guys. No, I'm impressed. I'm impressed by that. All right. It's a busy day. The news never stops. All right, Jen, we'll let you finish up. Rare glimpse into J.D. Salinger's archive coming to the New York Public Library. How did this happen? I mean, given how reclusive he was.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume he would not enjoy this. But Matt Salinger and the J.D. Salinger Literary Trust decided that it was time to sort of share some of his personal items with fans. His son, Matt, had said, you know, his immediate reaction was that he would not want this attention, but he thought about it a little bit more, and it was an opportunity to kind of, like, let fans get to know this really reclusive writer better. So they're bringing around 200 items to the library on October 18th, and that will run through January.
When you say items, what kind of things do I get to see?
So there's, you know, a lot of personal photos from when he was a child until later in life when, you know, when you didn't see him at all. And there's like handwritten and typewritten recipes, including one that instructs you to punch bags of kale that are frozen. And
my goodness.
And there's like typewriters, film projectors, and, you know, some books.
Books.
Letters.
Lots. This is a great description of himself. I'm a professional short story writer and novelist. I write fiction and only fiction. For more than 30 years, I have lived and done my work in rural New Hampshire. I was married there. My two children were raised there. I've been writing fiction rather passionately, single-mindedly, perhaps insatiably since I was 15 or so. I positively rejoice to imagine that sooner or later, the finished product safely goes to the ideal private reader, alive or dead, or yet unborn, male or female, or possibly neither. I think this sounds like
words.
I think this sounds like a really interesting glimpse into someone who, you know, everybody's read but knows so little about.
Yeah, and I feel like it's a respectful glimpse. There's been some like documentaries that have been a little bit salacious,
a little iffy. All right, with Gothamus, we're bookending with libraries. The good, the not as good but going to correct itself. Jen, Liz, Claire, Jake, Team Gothamus, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up, you go back to work now. We'll take a close look at the rise and fall of WeWork, the co-working unicorn startup whose IPO was one of the most highly anticipated of 2019. It was pulled and its CEO dumped. This is all of it.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.